This is continuing live courtroom coverage of the Take Care of Maya trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
This is a little bit different because what you have are telegraph punches. You have, and let's face it, the evidence taken as a whole indicates that there was a desire and plan on the part of Kathy Beattie to separate Maya from Beata, and she so stated. There was a plan by the hospital to force Beata and Maya to change, and Jack, to change their story. I don't think there's any question that there's enough evidence. In fact, we believe it's overwhelming evidence that that was the plan. The next question is, well, what about two Beata? And the facts here are that every single thing that Jack heard, saw, perceived, went to Beata. And so we argue that this was the intent of the hospital. And this is what's so horrible about all this. This was separation of mother from child, with knowledge by both, and without the ability to combat it. And so what you have here is a plan that is told to the mother that we are going to take away your child, and there's nothing you can do about it. There is nothing more outrageous in this society than, well, that. It is a fundamental, not only right, but it is a fundamental part of the human experience to raise your own child. And in this instance, we have people, and there is so much evidence in the record, it's overwhelming, that want to separate the two. And we're trying actively to separate the two. And that, the important thing, judges, that plan, that desire, was communicated to Beata over an extended period of time. And if you
I think to be fair, we need to excise out any contention that because there was reasonable cause for the abuse hotline report, and it was the court that authorized the sheltering. That's not Johns Hopkins, and they're not liable for that.
I understand the court's rule, and I have excised this out, and you saw that with the testimony of Dr. Richards today. Rather, what we're arguing is outrageous, is that over, and it's not the period of time so much as the sequence of events ramping up the pressure on Beata Kowalski, the directives from risk management going through Beattie, perpetrated by Beattie, communicated over, yes, a period of time, but not a period of time about false imprisonment, a period of time to raise the pressure on Beata by hearing about this, this, and this. And if this doesn't get her, let's take away the Christmas dress. And this doesn't get her, let's suggest that Jack get a divorce. And if this doesn't get her, let's tell her that I'm going to be her mother. All of these things, the evidence in the record is, were communicated to Beata. And so I asked the court to look at the series of events, not from the time, but from the ramp up, the steady ramp up of pressure on this mother, knowing that her hands were tied until, and this has always been our position here, that they intended some reaction out of Beata that would add to their story or serve as the end point to their story. See, Beata acted criminally and came in and tried to steal her child back, or see, Beata was out in front pounding on the window, or any other outrageous act on the part of Beata that would confirm their theory that Beata was crazy, had Munchausen by proxy, and was just afraid of getting caught. I don't know what the bizarre idea ultimately behind that part is, but I do know that these were doctors, and this was a hospital, and they understood that if you continue to keep the pressure on a mother in this circumstance, that mother is ultimately going to break in some form or fashion. And in this instance, what I think is they were surprised, and then I thought, but they weren't, because afterwards they said they expected it, and it had happened before. So to our point, Judge, the real outrageousness of this is the systematic nature of the actions against Beata through this. And everything, every contact that she had and everything she learned reinforced that there was a plan to take her daughter away. And that is outrageous in our society.
Your Honor, if I can, could I tag team in for just one moment to finish up on...
And this is why I said my precatory comments about this, because I want to be able to get through at least one of these motions before we have to leave today.
Yep.
So I will let you say it, and then I'll go to Mr. Altenburn for a response, and then we're finished.
Mr. Anderson's ramping up. The last ramp up, or maybe the last ramp up, is January 6th when they take the pictures of Maya, and that is relayed to Beata Kowalski, and she commits suicide the next day. That's my understanding. That not, if I've misspoken on that, I'm sorry, but that's my understanding, is she learned of it. So.
I think there's a question of whether there's any evidence of that issue in the record. Okay. Anything else before we go to Mr. Alton? Mr. Whitney?
I'm going to just make one comment, and I'll be done.
And I really probably need to, like, enforce the one lawyer, one argument type of rule, but since I haven't, go ahead, and then I really do need to move on.
The text messages reflect this plan. The comment in the text messages surrounding the EEG video and this targeting of Beata Kowalski is... I wouldn't put anything past her mother. That's it.
Mr. Alton.
I think that would put anything past her mother was Sally Smith, if I recall. But first of all, the notion that we are in a conspiracy to target this, A, conspiracy is not in this lawsuit at this moment in time, but B, I mean, it is speculation upon speculation to do this. The notion that these doctors, in attempting to take care of this child, were trying to... that they had some vendetta against the mother is simply not in this evidence, and it's really kind of an insult to the heart, to the hospital. This child came in with reports from the mother and the medical records from Lurie's and Tampa General Hospital indicating that they thought there was a psychological problem going on that was possibly Munchausen's by proxy. That's how this ends up on the front end of this. I think it's important to point out these two diagnoses aren't all that far apart. We're talking about a situation where a nerve or a muscle or whatever is not in fact damaged, but instead the delivery of the signals from that nerve to the brain are processed improperly in the brain. The CPRS people believe it's this glial cell ops situation, and the people who think that this is a factitious disorder believe that it's done through a psychological process. But nobody's claiming that Maya is faking it, that she's making it up. It's that psychologically, in her brain, however her brain works, one way or the other, there's something going on that's not real in her legs. It's a diagnosis issue. Maybe the diagnosis was for one or the other is different, but you've heard the testimony from all of the experts that the treatment for these things is physical therapy, occupational therapy, cognitive therapy, and if all that doesn't work as the last resort, you might consider ketamine. So in terms of us having a vendetta against this woman, the truth is we're simply trying to get a treatment package for her daughter that works. It's the court that has separated from us, and that is just a problem that is very hard for us to deal with. Now, as far as the lesions are concerned, yes, there's a disagreement between the doctors, and you can see it in the medical records, as to whether or not we think the little red dots and the little scratches that you've seen are actually things that are consistent with CRPS as compared to something else. That's a medical fight, but that's certainly not something that arises to the level of outrageous conduct. And finally, on the issue of direct or indirect, you know, virtually all intentional torts are things that are done toward a person. The notion that we will have a tort of this sort that is done because of things that are done in the hospital that her husband takes home, that some of which we probably know, but certainly not all of which we know is going home to mother, is simply not enough for this tort. I can say more, but we're going to run out of time. So unless you have more questions, I'm going to move on.
I do, and let me see if I can articulate it. Well, obviously, the conduct has to be so outrageous.
Yeah.
To me, not giving somebody a Christmas dress might be in bad form, but that by itself isn't
right.
Outrageous. But given the standard I have to apply on direct verdict, which means I have to take, you know, all the facts that are here in the light most favorable to the defense, what about the argument that we see a series of events that arguably are directed to Beata Kowalski, that evidence and intent to maliciously prevent and drive some type of wedge between mom and daughter? And I guess what my question is, am I able to, or should I look at the series of events which singularly might not, like the Christmas dress, might not be itself? Or is a series of events, any one of them by themselves is insufficient, but in combination is sufficient? And then I'll let Mr. Elegant comment on that. Or do I need some sort of one overwhelming direct conduct towards Beata, which is necessary to show outrage?
I don't think that the law requires one overwhelming specific incident. It can be things over a duration. But when you look at these things, as you say, that there are a number of things they complain about, like the dress and rudeness on the phone call and whatnot, that don't really accumulate much in this situation, and to claim that those things were done by the hospital because the hospital had some malicious plan to take this child from the parents. The decision whether the child was going to be taken from the parents was going to be made by a court in February based on evidence about medical child abuse. It had nothing to do with what the hospital was going to do in the interim. I don't see why they would even have thought they should have this kind of conspiracy. But moreover, the things you look at, we put her in an EEG room trying to videotape to see whether her conduct would be consistent or not with CRPS over a 48-hour period. We took photographs because she's beginning to have scratches that look to us like scratches and not like something from a disease. She's going out of the hospital, and we don't want to find out what she looks like when she comes back as to whether she has more scratches coming back than when she went in. Those things may seem, I don't know, invasive in some fashion, but they're not irrational, and they're not designed as a method to be malicious to anyone in that process. So, I mean, by that point in time, there are lawyers everywhere in this thing, and the hospital is just as concerned about this as the family is. And that process in the court is the overwhelming pressure on everyone in this case. So I submit to you that simply when you start with intentional infliction of emotional distress, it is not there, and that certainly when you jump to suicide, a suicide that takes place under these facts when nothing particular happens in the hospital she knows about in the last 72 hours and everything particular happens in the court after 100 days there, this can't be a case. We jump from intentional infliction to a suicide caused by that. There should be a directed verdict on both of those counts.
Mr. Elegant, did you want to respond to the question I asked Mr. Altmer, and then we'll move on after that?
Yes, Your Honor, I agree. It does not have to be a single incident. This is a series of incidents. It starts, as my colleague said, with the threat to arrest her at the very beginning. And it ramps up and up and up. They take away the toilet, move it from her. I mean, all these things. And again, the parents heard about it. The text message after the fact says predicts this was going to be a suicide. It's going to happen. I mean, this is a course. It doesn't have to be a conspiracy. They don't have to conspire to do it, but they did it. And it wasn't just the doctors. It was the staff. Thank you.
I'm going to take the directed verdict motion with respect to counts 21A and B under advisement. Mr. Alton, bring your next one, please.
The next would be count 21C, which is the same count for Maya Kowalski.
So for the clerk, the first one was on 21A and B. This one's on 21C. Count 21C.
This count is obviously different because Maya is in the hospital, and there are things that happen direct to you. And as you have noticed, a number of those things may rise to levels of rudeness and the like, but maybe not to extreme and outrageous conduct. The thing I'd like to really emphasize to you is that when the allegations in paragraphs 239 to 240 of the Eighth Amendment complaint are allegations where they go through and say, well, she was battered when she was in the hospital, and she was falsely imprisoned in the EEG room. They go through a list of things that are already the intentional torts that they are alleging elsewhere, torts that she's, if they prove, are going to get emotional damages. They don't need another tort for this. It's an overlay of that. And so when you take out the things they have alleged in here to make this and the things they claim they have proved here, the things that are left compared to the intentional torts that they have here are not sufficient, I don't believe, to cite a claim for intentional infliction of emotional distress. And at a minimum, if this goes to the jury, they need to be instructed that, you know, not only that the damages are not duplicative, I think the damages for the intentional torts they have alleged and this are essentially the same damages. So I don't believe that this count needs to go to the jury. I think it should have a directed verdict.
Assume for the sake of argument that the damages are duplicative. Is this something that the plaintiff would have to elect now, or would they be able to elect later?
I haven't thought about that. I mean, that obviously on 21A and B, if those two went in, there has to be an election. And the law is on that particular count that it would be an election after the fact. I was frankly envisioning something, if we had to do this, that would just tell them they couldn't duplicate over and over and over again, by the way, in this verdict form. But I know of no law that equates those two in a fashion that would require an election as compared to non-duplication.
Mr. Elliott.
Are you asking about that particular question?
Well,
or in general?
I think Mr. Altenburn was finished with his argument with respect to 21C. So your response, and then if you can throw in your comments as to my question.
I would agree that there is no requirement that says you have to, you would get rid of count 21C because it duplicates damages. If there's a duplication, there are ways to deal with that. But there's lots more going on for 21C. Have to keep in the context that all these things are being done to a 10-year-old girl who's sick, like moving the toilet away from her so she can't get to it. The religious aspects of what we've heard about. So all these things, and they are being done directly to her. So, and she also sees what's going on, you know, with her mother too, but sees or hears. So you have that as well. Again, unless you want to hear more, I think you already know the facts. You know what's going on. I mean, there's plenty here in my view.
I'm going to deny the motion with respect to 21C, the light most favorable to the non-moving party here, the plaintiff. The court finds this to be a jury question.
Okay.
And then we can address the potential duplication issue in the jury instructions when we get there.
All right. Next, I'm moving to count 6C, which is a negligent infliction of emotional distress count, both for Mr. Kowalski and a separate claim for his daughter, Maya Kowalski. They have similar issues, and although Maya's is somewhat more complicated. As I'm sure you know, that under the traditional Champion versus Gray and Zell line of cases, you have to have, in some fashion, experienced a tort that was committed on a close family member, and that has to have caused you emotional distress, and the emotional distress then has to, in turn, cause a physical injury. The requirement in Brown is that it be one that such psychological trauma must cause a demonstrable physical injury such as death, paralysis, muscular impairment, or similar objectively discernible physical impairment before a cause of action may exist. So I've cited to you before in Elliott versus Elliott, the First District found that headaches and diabetes and sleep apnea and stress and insomnia, anxiety, loss of appetite, and hair loss, bowel trouble aren't enough.
And I know we've been having this argument
over
and over. And did I actually write on this issue?
You denied a summary judgment based upon what was in was there as compared to what we have now.
But did I make, in that denial of summary judgment, did I make comments about the Zell case and these other guys? I'm trying to remember.
I don't remember. The one thing I want to tell you about Zell, though, is because it gets misquoted, I think maybe even in a comment to the jury, the standard jury instruction. In Zell, the woman experienced watching her father get blown up by a bomb. She gets severe stomach problems. Those problems get worse and worse. She ends up getting various treatment. She's diagnosed with fibromyalgia and with an orthodontal dysphagia, which is a problem in her esophagus. She gets a medical doctor that says all of this is caused by the stress. In his medical opinion, he says, additionally, in my opinion, within a reasonable degree of medical probability, she has suffered from insomnia and anxiety with a depressed mood. That gets picked up as, oh, that's enough for the cause of action. But that was the additional part that follows things that were enough for medical diagnoses of real physical injury. So the Zell gets taken out of context, and the language in Brown versus Cadillac has never been receded from by the Florida Supreme Court, nor has anyone criticized the language in Elliott versus Elliott. What we have here is he says when he first got on the stand that he had anger, loss of sleep, diarrhea, nausea, and trouble digesting food. That's not enough. He has tired and a little nausea was what he said the second time on the stand. And then he added that he had sometime a couple years afterwards about an eczema that he apparently got treatment for. But the eczema, unlike in Zell, there's no medical doctor that says that there was treatment, there's no bills, and there's no medical opinion that eczema was somehow caused by this particular incident a couple of years earlier. We've heard in the testimony, I think eczema kind of runs in this family to begin with. So I don't think the eczema is enough. And then the last thing we heard was Dr. Brewerton, who evaluated the family for PTSD. And he said, and I was very careful listening to this, based on the events from October 2015 through January of 2016, he thought that Mr. Kowalski had PTSD. And he tried to make that an organic disease by saying that there's evidence that sometimes that there's a loss of brain tissue in the hippocampus section of the brain. Now, he didn't do any tests on this on Mr. Kowalski to say there'd been brain damage here. And frankly, there's no medical bills, and there's been no treatment whatsoever to this point in time for PTSD. So my position is that from viewing the things that he saw in the hospital concerning his daughter, there are the claim for negligent infliction. Not only is this not tied to that, but none of this is enough to reach the level where this goes to the jury as the physical injury that's required.
And just, I did write on the Champion and Zell. It's the DIN 3133 docket identification number 3133, which is June 26, 2023 order. And basically I agreed with Justice Cantero's decision in Willis that was joined by Justices Well and Bell about the impact rule and its continued viability.
So, right.
I was going to say, I remember writing it.
You did write, but I wasn't going to tell you what you did write. Jumping quickly to Maya, by the way, she has the first threshold that what's the underlying negligent act she viewed. There's no negligent claim for the mother. The jury instructions they proposed are the negligent treatment of the parents in the hospital, but there's no jury that has made or will make a finding on that. So I don't think she has the predicate to begin with. But then I listened very carefully to her testimony sitting here, and she talks about all the problems she's had with the CPRS, but I didn't hear a single thing where she said she went to the doctor or had particular problems because she had witnessed something related to her parents. Not even the suicide of her mother is something that she claimed caused something here. There's just simply no evidence that she has had the kind of demonstrable physical injury that is required for this. So I don't think either one of these counts have been proven. We'd get a directed verdict on both of these.
Thank you, Mr. Altenburn. Mr. Elegant.
Your Honor, admittedly, I was not here, but I understand there's testimony from Mr. Kowalski that testifying to nausea, insomnia, diarrhea, headaches, vomiting, certainly those are physical manifestations.
And I think there's case law that list out those specific ailments, and talking about probably is not enough.
Some of them, I don't know about the, I mean, vomiting is a pretty well... You know, that's a little different than headache. Let me go on to mine. I'll come back and let my more knowledgeable factual counsel help with that. But on Maya's, and we have, I know we'll be talking jury instructions with you in a bit, but the case law refers to her, refers to a person hearing. You don't just have to see it. There's not so much you can hear something going on that causes emotional distress that's being done to someone else, and you hear it, and it causes you the emotional distress. That is sufficient. And she overhears her parents being threatened to be jailed during the first week. She overhears conversations with her mother where she's being accused, and including being accused of things and so forth. So there's plenty going on there. It's not like you have to witness a physical thing happening. Mr. Kowalski certainly witnessed plenty. I mean, he had to clean up after his daughter when they moved the, you know, they fix it so she can't get to the bathroom. So, he clearly has that. I don't think we heard that argument, but hearing it is sufficient for Maya's situation. Anything else? Well, do you want to?
This is the plaintiff's opportunity to.
Yeah.
Say whatever they want to say as it relates to this motion.
He has dysphagia. He goes long periods of time without being able to swallow.
As far as physical manifestations, I understand Maya's experts have testified that these things have had an impact on her, physical impact on her not getting better or getting worse. And I understand Mr. Kowalski also has dysphagia. That he's testified to, swallowing difficulty and so forth. So again, that's another, I would say, physical ailment that is beyond, you know, simply a headache.
Mr. Anderson, go for it.
You're a very patient judge. I thought that Dr. Brewerton went through in detail that the PTSD that they both suffered actually goes in and organically restructures the brain. That is a physical injury. Now, the cause is the PTSD, but I think he testified that the latest data on that indicates that the brain itself goes through a process and rewires itself to keep it in, to keep these physiological reactions going. That rewiring is a physiological change. And that occurred with both Maya and with Jack. And Dr. Brewerton was very, very clear about that, and that this was related to the what happened to them. So I'd ask the court to take that into account. We now know more about PTSD and the fact that it
it has a physiological component. It hasn't been addressed by the case law yet, but that's the latest science.
Anything else, Mr. Elegant?
Not that I can think of right now, Your Honor.
And Mr. Altenburg, last rebuttal word.
Very, very briefly. Again, this is an account for having viewed a negligent act. They've tried to bring in other intentional acts. That's never really been alleged. But even if it were alleged, the testimony from the experts has been about this whole range of things that goes from A to Z and not the things that happen just in the hospital. And B, that while the theory is that it causes this restructuring in the brain, there's absolutely no evidence that any doctor has ever found that whatsoever in these two people. They haven't even really been treated for this disease in the, what has it been, 6 years since this event took place. So there is no evidence in this case to present to the jury that there's a physical impairment that's been diagnosed by our doctor or treated, and there is not enough to go to a jury.
Okay, I'm going to take the directed verdict motion with respect to count 6C. Under advisement. And Madam Court Reporter, I'm going to want the entirety of the arguments on directed verdict starting at 3 o'clock today till the time we finish. I'm going to want a transcript and of them, when I say as soon as possible, hopefully tomorrow or maybe Wednesday, if possible. Okay, Mr. Altenburg, you have the floor for the next
motion. Yeah, I'm jumping to count 18, which is fraudulent billing. Technically, the count is alleged for all plaintiffs, but I think maybe they really think it's only a count for Mr. Kowalski at this point in time. I don't know that it makes really that much difference. This is a count for intentional fraud. It's not a count for negligent misrepresentation or anything else. So they are alleging right out of the standard jury instructions that the issues for you to decide are whether John Hopkins made a false statement concerning a material fact in the bills to the Kowalskis and their insurance companies, and whether John Hopkins knew the statement was false when it made it, whether John Hopkins intended that another would rely upon the false statement, and whether they relied, and whether either the Kowalskis or the insurance company relied on the false statement, and I guess we didn't stipulate on detriment, so whether that caused a detriment to these people. So the evidence you've heard, let's start with the basics. Nobody from the billing department at John Hopkins has been called. Bills have just been put into evidence with a number on it along with a list of other things. And no one from Aetna has been called to say that they thought there was any problem with these billings the way they were done. The only person who testified about them until this morning was Mr. Kowalski. And Mr. Kowalski went through a list of bills from Exhibit 2017, and he would show you, yes, indeed, that this bill was sent to the insurance company. And so, for example, 17739 was sent to them with a $90,800 first offer, I guess, from the hospital. And the insurance company paid $50,853. And his theory is that, I guess, we didn't do work for CRPS for them in the hospital. Well, first of all, he doesn't know what was billed for that amount, and he doesn't know whether it's the $40,000 that was taken off that bill, for example. But secondly, it's undisputed that this child was in a hospital room, in a hospital bed for roughly 100 days, and that this child received occupational therapy, physical therapy, cognitive therapy, and things that, without regard to whether this was CRPS or factitious disorder, that treatment was the same for both of them in the hospital. And even their experts recognize that is recognized treatment. They believe that we should have gone on and used ketamine, but they recognize those treatments. So the notion that someone reviewed that bill at John Hopkins and thought that that was a material fact that they were lying about to the insurance company, and that the insurance company relied upon that to pay an amount they never would have paid, the evidence is simply not there. They've not put on the people that they would need to present that. And you know, then, you know, the to their detriment, the only thing they've discussed is a lien, which if there's a verdict in this, in the way it is, they can argue all that to you at the end of this case, just like they do in every other case to get it resolved there. Or, their other thing is the deductible. They admit it's a deductible for the year. They have no idea what that deductible was used for, and this girl went through a litany of things that year. So there really is no proof of fraudulent billing that can go to the jury in this case.
And let me hear from the plaintiffs, and let me first ask about, is there any evidence that the personal representative of Fiata's estate or Jack Kowalski as Maya's parent?
More live courtroom coverage of the Take Care of Maya trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today is coming up. Press subscribe now.
Normally in these ads, you'd expect someone like me to ask you to buy something. But I want to ask you to do something different. I'm Dave Farenthold, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm an investigative reporter, which means that I follow the money, inside of government and outside of government. The point of my job is to find things people are trying to hide. It involves talking to lots of people. It involves looking through lots and lots of documents. And if there weren't folks like me to go beyond the surface to understand who is really shaping what the government does, the public will be left in the dark about what the government's doing with your tax money, what the government's doing to you through regulations and spending. If you're like me and you think this kind of journalism is important, seek out a news source that does firsthand, fact-based reporting. If that's the New York Times, thank you. If that's your local paper, that's great too, because where you get your information matters.